I'm here with Arjun Basu. Arjun is a Montreal writer and marketer and a foodie. And he is the author of a book that was just released called Waiting for the Man, which was long listed for the 2014 Scotiabank Giller Prize. So why don't we start?
You know, the list, Lake Superior State comes out with a list every year of words that should be banned. Mm-hmm. And this year's list included things like bay, you know, and curate, which I'm very happy about. But one of them was foodie. I'm just telling you.
Okay.
That you just uttered a banned word.
Then I'll be very, what would be a better word?
I don't know. They had a word for, they had like a replacement, which was also not acceptable. So I think we're in that weird zone where we don't have a word for what you expressed.
What if we called you a voluptuary? Does that work?
I don't know. The image I get from that is very Rubenesque.
Yeah. Well, so you're somebody who knows restaurants and eats in restaurants and has written about them and therefore has something interesting to say. We won't use the word foodie. Yeah. we'll avoid it. You're probably your highest public profile lately is for the book Waiting for the Man. Do you want to tell me a little bit about it? What is the book about and how did it come to be? And
Waiting for the Man is about what happens when you start listening to the voices in your head. I mean, we all talk to ourselves, some of us more than others. I think when we get at it's a story about a guy who's actually on the surface very successful. He's a copywriter at an ad agency at a very, sounds like a very hip ad agency in New York. He's done campaigns for everything from like diapers to beer to hip dog food. And he has an identity crisis and, he starts to hear this voice in his head and this voice becomes really insistent and, he ends up listening to it. So it's a story about on one hand, it's a story about, just a person's sort of existential crisis. But on the other hand, it's sort of a takedown or a commentary on marketing and media and like that vanishing line between news and entertainment. On the American notion of the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. And it all comes together in hopefully a surprising way if you haven't read it. And I was quite pleased with it. It took a long time to write.
Your main character's name is Joe.
Yes.
Right? He's an advertising copywriter, a marketing guy.
Yes.
Very unhappy.
Yes.
He ends up quitting his job.
Yeah.
He decides to sit on
his front steps.
Yeah, his front steps. And
he becomes a media sensation.
For doing nothing. This is the autobiographical question. Where did this character come from in your subconscious? And why Joe?
His name's Joe because I wanted like the most innocuous name. I didn't want a name, that either was something you could pun or something that was interesting. I want a really flat, everyman sort of name. But the story came out of, I had three images in my head, and one of them was this guy who I didn't know who he was at the time, just sitting on his front steps waiting for something. Another image was the same guy in a car with a Japanese hitchhiker. And the third image was what is basically the last scene in the book. And so a lot of, the first few drafts were just trying to bring these things together, connect the dots. As the story developed, I got into his occupation. I got into, the idea of the media. I think I got into the idea of the media first before he became a copywriter.
Why the media? Because you work, which we will address in a moment, but as somebody who works in brand iconic, you do work in the media, and you were formerly a book editor of children's books at Tundra Books.
Yeah.
So your book is in some ways a critique of the media, or in a major way a critique of the media, because you have a protagonist who's unhappy who comes from that world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what? What
well,
was your
he's
point
unhappy,
of view?
But he's also, you know, I think he's in the media, or the significance of him being in the media is that he is a storyteller himself. In this case, he writes stories to sell products. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot that I could play with in that. You know, someone told me that the whole story is a metaphor for storytelling, really. You know, I have sort of this Greek chorus that develops around him in the form of the crowd that comes to watch him do nothing every night. And then the media itself becomes sort of a megaphone for that crowd and sort of becomes a filter the way the media is. So I don't know that, at least the way I wrote it or in my head, how significant his actual life as a advertising person is, as much as he self-identifies as a storyteller. And that's the one thing that he sort of can't escape. And then he can't escape his need or desire to spin everything into sort of ad speak or whatever. Mm.
So you mentioned that you started your career as an editor of children's books at
yes.
Tundra Books.
Yes.
What did you study in school?
Creative writing and film.
At Concordia?
Yes.
University?
Yes.
Okay. So you are a bona fide writer with a rich creative background in Montreal. I mean, it's in your DNA and in your formation all the way. Is it something you've always wanted to do?
I don't know that I've always wanted to. I mean, I didn't grow up wanting to be a writer. I wasn't very bookish when I was growing up. I had a lot of books. My father and mother were both very...
You're from Côte Saint-Luc, right?
Yeah, that's where I grew up. They bought me a lot of books. They didn't push it, you know. They didn't say, are you reading, you know. They didn't yell from the other room, read your book. But I think when I was about 15 or 16, the idea of writing started to appeal to me, but it still wasn't something that I was committed to. Mm. And then I found out that, you know, after around CJEP time, I found out that there was actually such a thing as creative writing. I didn't even know it, that existed. Mm. And I think when I was in there, I got into it. You know, the idea of doing this all the time. The other interesting twist in that road, and I mean, I still wasn't sure, but I was friends with, you know, one of the Richler boys in CJEP. So I'd go over there.
Which one?
With Jacob. So I'd go over to their house, you know, to their house down in downtown or their country place and the townships. And I, you know, most of the time I saw, you know, Mordecai smoking a cigarillo and playing snooker, but often, you know, I saw him writing, especially
Mordecai
Richler. Yeah. I saw him writing mostly up in the townships. I mean, he did most of his writing there. And very disciplined, you know. I mean, he was in his office all day. And then at night he'd go to the pub, or he'd, you know, have a scotch and play snooker. But very, very disciplined. Like we'd be up late, and then we'd stumble out of, you know, our rooms at, you know, noon, and he was just writing away or just thinking or just surrounded by notes and everything.
So that gave you the image of a writer as a hard-working, disciplined person.
It gave me the image of writing as it gave me an image. You know, I think the image I had was maybe probably from the movies or something. I mean, I didn't read a lot of biographies about writers or anything. But I actually saw a writer at work, seeing a writer at work and seeing a writer of that caliber mm-hmm. at work, and just the grunt work that goes into it. You know, seeing him sort of, you know, lying down on the couch, just like reading, you know, his research was incredible. I think he was working on Solomon Gursky, so there would be a lot of research.
Yeah.
But just, you know, like photocopied stencils of stuff that he's just reading.
This is like 81, 82?
Something like that, yeah. No, later. Anyway.
Yeah.
Just seeing a writer at work for the first time, I think. I think that impressed me. I didn't say, like, wow, I want to do that, because it looked like he was doing what didn't look...
doesn't sound like
fun. It didn't look sexy at all, yeah. You know, at all. But it made the whole idea of writing concrete.
So you, as I mentioned, you're a book editor in, that was, this, I guess, 20 years ago, something like that, is when you started?
Yeah.
So... I want to ask about what you're doing now, but before I do that, in English Montreal in particular, but in Canada and generally, how do you feel that the publishing world has changed? Because you've actually, in your journey from editor to short story to out through the tweets and then back into a novel, and it's a classic novel on paper, et cetera, though I'm sure there is an e-book version.
There is, and it was on sale this past week.
Yes, and people should buy it. Available at Amazon and Chapters, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you feel has changed, if anything? Yeah, and actually, and you saw Mordecai Richler, great Canadian novelist at work as a youth.
Yeah.
You know, in your lifetime, what's changed? What's different or what's the same?
Well, the craft hasn't changed. You know, the industry has changed a lot. I mean, there was a large disruption, obviously, with the web. The publishing industry changed because it wasn't sure what to do about anything digital. Mm-hmm. You know, even though they had sort of a 10 years to watch what happened to the music industry, they learned absolutely nothing. And then the booksellers themselves, they went from being basically a mom and pop operations to the first wave of, was the big box stores that came in. And, sort of hurt a lot of the mom and pop operators. And then, then Amazon started, and that had its own effect. So those things, it sounds like a lot of things got totally screwed up in the industry. But at the end of the day, where are we back now? At least in Canada, you have a pretty thriving independent book scene again. Mm-hmm. Indigo is doing, I think if it wasn't selling other stuff, they probably wouldn't be making any money at all. Mm-hmm. Amazon is good at what it does. More people are reading than ever before. It's just that the formats have all changed. And then tablets came in, but they've plateaued. So the whole e-reader idea has plateaued as well. Mm. I think e-books, the digital side is maybe 30% of the industry. So in a very short amount of time, they took a third of the industry.
Right.
But they seem to have plateaued at that. So we went through a period of complete change where everyone was just throwing things at a wall and seeing what would stick. And we're back on the other side where things have settled again. It's like sort of, a lake after a storm. It looks like the lake before the storm, but everything's changed, moved around. The fact that like independent bookstores sort of survived, it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. A lot of publishers didn't. There's been a lot of consolidation in the industry. There's a handful of really strong independent publishers in Canada. Everything else is owned by the conglomerates, by the foreigners, really.
Right.
And they're giant companies. And the same things happen in the States.
It must have always been hard to sell books.
That's the thing, I think people talk about, these people are going out of business and, the publishers are struggling. It's like, well, publishers' margins were never great,
Yeah.
I mean, you hope that you have at least one Stephen King in your stable, someone like that.
But I'm also assuming that many publishers are surviving through cookbooks and children's books.
Of course. I mean, there's all sorts of things, I was signing, because my book was done in French, and I was signing at the Salon du Livre last month. Mm-hmm. And my publisher is a small, great independent publisher here, but they're distributed by Hachette. So we were in the Hachette booth, which is just enormous.
Right.
It's one of the largest French publishers and distribution companies
they
in the world.
They also sell the 20th anniversary Cirque book I wrote, plug. They bought Harry and Abrams, so.
They're just a massive company, and half the booth was like coloring books.
Sure.
Like these new coloring books for adults.
All right. in the, you know, when you're not writing novels and yes. short stories on Twitter, you are a editor in chief, executive editor here.
I'm now, my title is Senior Vice President of Content Strategy.
Senior Vice President at Content Strategy at SpaFax.
Yes.
Which is a company that produces media. Branded and content of
branded
all kinds.
Content and content marketing for all kinds, yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, SpaFax, where we are sitting now, began as the publishers of airline magazines?
Yeah, basically. I mean, SpaFax actually started, the first thing they ever did was a safety video for British Airways. Mm. That was the first thing they ever did, and it was the first safety video. Because before that, it was the flight attendants who were doing everything, and then, you know, you had the screens, and so someone at British Airways had the good idea of, well, why don't we just put the safety video there?
If somebody's listening to this, and yeah. they don't know, or they read the, you know, the preface I'm going to write, and they don't know what branded content is.
Yeah.
Marketers do, many people don't. So if yeah. you're sitting on a plane and you look at, and you're on Air Canada and you see En Route,
yeah.
that's a form of branded content. It's Air Canada's paid for you. How would you describe branded content to somebody who doesn't know what it is?
Branded content is just a form of marketing. It's another form of marketing. It's a more immersive form of marketing. Often it's it takes the form of traditional media. And it tells
magazines,
you know, video, audio, I mean, a podcast, websites. And it spins stories. And depending on the mandate, either it spins stories that are completely agnostic to the brand, to the brand's own message, mm-hmm. or it's actually very closely tied.
Right.
But the idea is that it's not the short-term hard sell of an ad. That it's a longer-term form of marketing that helps in things like loyalty and engagement and even recall.
So let's take the En Route example, for instance. That's one that most yeah. listeners will know because most people fly Air Canada. What was your – you began as an editor with En Route?
I began as a copy editor at En Route in around 2000.
And what does that entail? What were the guidelines for En Route for content? What were you looking for?
And did
you, sorry to interrupt, but were you forced to stay on message by Air Canada? Were there strict guidelines for the brand? Tell me a little bit about your work. Yeah.
There weren't. I mean, Air Canada's, every client is different, for sure. But Air Canada has had some form of in-flight entertainment, which is really content marketing, for a long time. Mm. They were one of the first in the world. To have, you know, a magazine and then the whole in-flight entertainment system and everything. I mean, they've really been pioneers that way. So when I came on board, the airline was, you know, they had sort of a mission statement, let's just say, for what they wanted. And then they trusted us to interpret it. The only thing that they wanted to make sure was that... the destinations were okay. Mm. They didn't even have to be destinations that Air Canada flew to. Because, I mean, theoretically, with their alliances and everything, you can get anywhere in the world. When I became editor-in-chief, we were still, it was just a magazine. There was nothing else. And it was also a difficult time for the client. I mean, it was after 9/11. We launched my first issue, I think, 5 days before 9/11. Mm. So that happened, then SARS happened, then, I mean, Air Canada had financial difficulties. And so as a client, you know, they had other worries, and they trusted us to produce a good magazine. And, you know, our numbers really held during that time. It was very difficult time for Air Canada. But from a sales point of view, our numbers were pretty solid.
How were you able to measure the sales of En Route? Sold the magazine sales? Like the magazine stand
advertising.
Sales? Advertising, okay.
Advertising. I mean, that's the metric for En Route.
Right.
Or what, for the magazine. The other thing that happened, though, as I became... So as we survived that, the other thing that happened is that media started to change.
Right. So for every listener who doesn't get it...
Yeah.
Somebody, you know, if Air Canada, who pays for a magazine like En Route for its...
They don't pay a cent
they don't pay for it because they're carrying advertising covers from it. Yeah. Other brands. So yep. It's a one brand that's making money from
other advertising brands because Air Canada offers a fantastic audience.
Right. Especially in Montreal, I'm sure on the Windsor, Montreal, Toronto, Windsor Quarter route is the business hub of Canada.
The metrics, the audience metrics for en route are fantastic.
Right.
So you have that. But you know, again, as media has changed, it's we've had to adapt and create more touch points and more media because our readers. The readers or Air Canada's customers are not always, well, one, they're not always on the plane. Two, they want information before they get on the plane. They want information after.
Does that mean that you're creating content for, let's say, the Air Canada app before people board?
We've always talked about the journey cycle. And the journey cycle is a circle. And, you know, a quarter of that time is a quarter of that circle is on the plane. The quarter before that is the planning. Then you have this period after it where it's sort of a little dead, but you're starting to think about things, and then you have research.
So where will you come into the portrait?
So it used to be that we were just in that quarter when we were on the plane, and then we tried to expand our quarter of the circle both ways, either, you know, when someone was going into a lounge or at the airport, or right after, you know, at the gate, whatever. Then we got a website, which was basically just mirroring the content of the magazine. But it was good. It just allowed us to archive the thing as opposed to doing it physically. Mm-hmm. But for the reader, it allowed them to, you know, if they didn't take the magazine, even though we always tell them it's yours to keep, they always say, I stole the magazine off the plane, because you can't really take anything off a plane except for the magazine. If they miss something, you know, there would be a place to go. And then when we started Canada's Best New Restaurants, which we did in 2004-ish.
As a separate media initiative?
We basically decided that the November issue was going to be about food. Mm-hmm. And as a travel magazine, you know, we realized that when you're traveling, you sort of know where you're going to stay. If you're traveling on business, your itinerary to a certain extent is set for you. You have no idea where you're going to eat, ever. If you're a tourist, that's true. If you're a businessman, that's also true. So we decided, and Best New Restaurants, I mean, the States had 3 or 4 of them. I was a big fan of the one in Esquire. But it's a very expensive endeavor. And, you know, we thought, well, I think we might be the only ones who could do it.
Expensive because you have to get people to go and eat there and review it?
Because you have to get one person to go across the country and eat at the best restaurants.
And on en route, you had many people in many places, and you could do it or how did it work?
At en route, at least we could get the people there. Mm-hmm. So we did it, and it was a huge... The first one we did landed on the front page of all the national papers. And so that the success of that led to ideas like, well, we need to put more stuff about the restaurants that didn't make the cut. So that went on the website. It led to an idea about an app so that people would always have the addresses in their phones. And so in many ways, it led us off the plane, so to speak, and into a broader media, which is where a lot of Air Canada's media now exists. I mean, en route is a very small part of it now.
And I want to talk about that. But before I get to that, because you've opened the restaurant door, and without saying the F word, which is now forbidden, this gives you an interesting global view of restaurants around the world, but also in Canada specifically. So,
yeah.
Here's an opportunity to opine about the food scene generally in Montreal, in Canada, in the U.S. Clearly you have experienced it. You must have a point of view on it.
Well, I think one of the interesting things that happened with Canada's Best New Restaurants is it it came on the scene around the same time that Canadians start to take food seriously. Where the idea of Canadian cuisine, which, you know, outside of maybe Quebec, was something that people would laugh at or would think of really like sort of down market stuff.
Right.
Where cities like, I mean, Toronto and Vancouver had already happened, but where Toronto really started to come into its own as a great food destination. So it mirrored sort of a rise in the Canadian consciousness of food. And so, you know, where it would be almost impossible to get anything but a good steak in Calgary, you know, 15 years ago, you know, I mean, now you can get a good everything in Calgary. I mean, it's a fantastic food city. And the same is true of pretty much every major city in the country, and also now a lot of smaller places. So that's been an interesting thing to see. I think, you know, the rise of a higher sense of regionalism in food and terroir, again, something that Vancouver's always experienced just because of the bounty of Vancouver and that area. Something that's always been important here in Quebec, but now even, you know, I mean, Toronto, just that idea of locally grown food is so important. And the Maritimes has taken a new pride in their own cuisine. And then that feeds on itself, no pun intended, because you get these chefs who come up and who come up inspired by those ideas, not inspired by things they've learned in like New York or London or wherever, and inspired by their local cuisine and a local chef. And you see that, you've seen in Montreal, just, you know, certain kitchens from pretty innocuous restaurants from a long time ago, like Med, you know, Med in the 80s. And it was an okay restaurant. It was part of the St. Lawrence Strip and everything. But the chefs that came out of there, I mean, Joe Mercury came out of there, you know, Dave and Fred came out. I mean, this incredible amount of people came out of there.
Right, Dave McMillan.
And Fred Moran. These guys helm like the best restaurants, not just in the city, but in the country. So, so that happened as well. These scenes sort of developed. And I find that a lot of, at least in Montreal, like the chef community, they talk to each other a lot.
Yeah.
And they're not really cutthroat as they are in other places, in some other places. And there's just this sharing of ideas. And so you do have, local flavor that comes out, you know, sort of new local flavors. I'm in Montreal for a while. It was impossible not to eat and get fat. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's like the food was so rich, and you just think of like Pierre Cochon or
right.
Joe Beef or something. I mean, the plates were just loaded with stuff, and it became this Montreal thing that everything was going to have foie gras on it.
Right.
And like
they're going to kill you. They're going to kill you.
And it was a reaction to, for sure, to the sort of very pretty and fancy French food that we'd been eating.
It's almost nihilistic.
But it also, you know, I was reading last year a review of John Gould in Los Angeles, and he was reviewing this one restaurant. I think it was a list of his favorite restaurants of the year or something, and he was reviewing this one restaurant which he called like completely inspired by Montreal. Mm-hmm. And he didn't even have to say anything. Like his readers, and it was not for like the LA Times or something. It was for his, I think it was Serious Eats, so it's like a F word, you know, website.
Yes.
And he didn't have to like qualify that.
Right.
Like everyone sort of understood that Montreal meant something in terms of, and I was curious about that. So I saw that he actually had talked about the influence of sort of the over the top Montreal haute cuisine that was happening and how it influenced all of North America, because chefs now are so mobile and they come up here and they taste something and they go to something like Joe Beef or Pied Cochon or something, and they go back to their cities and they replicate it. And I mean, it's not like it's a one way street; it happens both ways.
Right.
So I think you know, Montreal has, in that sense, a really interesting and lively food culture. And it's not new; it's a continuation of what we always had. But
well, now it's become like almost a subculture. You know, it's taken on a subcultural edge with places like Joe Beef, where, you know, their young hipsters become chefs.
And it's like a subculture, but it's also it's not a bad culture. It adds so much to the city, And every city has one, you know. Right. And I like the fact, you know, traveling a lot, you know, everyone would always say, oh, everything's the same. I'm like, if you think everything's the same, you're not really looking, you know, because right. I think everything is different. Every city, even in this, you know, and that's a label that always gets put on the States. You know, all the cities are the same. It's like, that's really not true.
As a traveling Montrealer, I'm sure it's expected of you that you know food and you know how to order off a menu, and I'm sure most places you go, it's kind of bestowed upon you, no?
You know, it used to be more, but I really think that food culture in North America has evolved so much that we probably can't really give lessons to people anymore, if we ever could.
That's a good thing, because that means there's good stuff everywhere, right?
There is good stuff everywhere.
Right. The culture's changed.
The culture's changed. There's good stuff everywhere. I mean, you know, I love it when people say, like, you know, that British food is terrible. That just tells me they haven't been to Britain in probably 20 years.
Right, right.
Because London is just a cornucopia. It's just fantastic to eat in London.
That's true. And more inventive probably than some other countries that are known as...
Absolutely. It's one of the premier food cities in the world right now.
You've described... You've said on your webpage that you think Montreal is awesome. Do you still think Montreal is awesome?
Yeah,
why?
I do.
Yeah, what's awesome about us besides the winter and...
Besides the gray day we have today.
And strikes and...
Well, I like that it sort of is... It's not just different from other cities, because I just said all cities are different, but it's more different. And it sort of demands... It has this weird push-pull between demanding that it be allowed to be different and wanting to be a part of the club, you know?
Right.
I think the dynamic here is really interesting. I think the people are interesting here. I think
we want to be a bigger city. We want to be better,
but we don't want the things that go with it, and we don't want the hassle of that. But you know, we're always like, you know, raising our hand, saying, "Look at me," you know. And then when you look, you're like, maybe you put it down and say, "Okay, well, that's enough," you know. But I think we're lucky in that we have the stuff that sort of big cities have without being so big,
right?
Which is, I think, that's what makes it unique, you know. And I just like the energy here. I find the energy here is very different from other cities.
I want to ask you some questions to do with grilled, particularly, but I just want to go back to one thing. I want to ask you another thing about Spot Facts, because it seems to be such an interesting company and doing so many interesting things. I just want to make it clear to those who are listening. For instance, not only do you publish the magazine for Air Canada, but I believe you curate all of the video content and others. You license it, correct, for the in-flight entertainment?
So we produce or curate the video content for over 60 airlines around the world.
Right. So how many magazines, how many videos? Give me quantify for them. Give me a metric.
So, you know, it's funny that you're saying that, because I think just a few months ago we tried to come up with these numbers. So the magazines, I mean, we produce over, I think it's 1,000 or 2,000 pages a month. We sell, or maybe that's the number of ads we sell a month, pages. The amount of video we curate a month is in the thousands of hours. For Air Canada, getting back to them, we also sell the advertising there. And so because we control sort of the chains on the TV screen in front of you, as well as the magazine, as well as the lounges, we can talk to you, or we can allow brands to speak to you at different moments of your journey there, or in different media, at different times.
So who are the other airlines?
So, British Airways is our oldest client. We're based in London. British Airways was our first client with that safety video. And we do some video production for them, but we also do all their in-flight entertainment. But Air Canada, so between British Airways and Air Canada, those are our two largest accounts. Air Canada is our most varied account. British Airways is just larger, just by the fact that it's a much larger airline.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some airlines that we might do something, you know, something as small as just won't even produce the videos. We'll just do the movie guide. And then there's some airlines like Air Canada where we do a lot.
It sounds like a great job.
And it's not just airlines, right? I mean, we do, like in this office, we're producing things for like hotel chains and for Mercedes-Benz and Bombardier and Investors Group. I mean,
so hotel chains, you'll do the in-room magazine, for instance?
Yeah, and hopefully more things. And and then, you know, tourism bureaus. And so our list is quite varied.
So you're straddling the line often in between journalism and or light journalism and marketing, or is it?
Yeah, I think there's that's happening more and more. I think you'll find a lot of journalists are working for brands now.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing, do you think?
Well, you know, I mean, on the one hand, journalists are coming over because traditional media is having problems.
Yeah.
And that's a bad thing, I think, you know. When you see the numbers for, you know, newspapers and, you know, whatever, I mean, newspapers are regardless of how we feel about them, they're important. They are, if they're working, what keeps us honest. Now, there are many other ways to do that now, but they all have to be paid somehow. Mm-hmm. So either we go to a system where we pay for it directly, or we go to a system where it's supported by ads.
Right. And then we're dependent upon the marketer's honesty.
And we're dependent upon the marketer's honesty and the end of the day, yeah, the client's honesty in terms of why they're doing something.
Right.
Luckily, I think we live in an age where sort of sneaky ideas don't last too long because someone's going to figure it out.
Right.
And when they figure it out, they tell everyone about it now because they have the means to do so. So, you know, I mean, like Air Canada, back to that example, I mean, they just want to have the best sort of media around. You know, many years ago, it was the magazine was all over the place. It had a little business, and we really focused it on. Then it became travel and lifestyle, and now it's really just a travel magazine. I mean, even the food component of it is related to travel,
right?
Because that's what people are doing. And frankly, Canada doesn't really have a travel magazine or travel media. So, you know, I think a few years ago, the staff here just said, "Well, why not?"
And, you know, from a marketing point of view, Air Canada's got your money by the time you sit down and get that magazine.
You know, it's interesting you say that. Yeah. That, you know, many years ago, someone once said that actually in-flight magazines could be the purest reading experience that you have because of exactly that. Like, I mean, you're sitting in the seat. Air Canada's won. You've paid your money already. Right. All they want you to do is feel comfortable. So they give you a movie. I mean, what are they selling you with a movie on the screen? You saw X-Men on Air Canada. Where was the message for Air Canada there? They're just giving you a pleasant flying experience. And the magazine does the same thing. The magazine, though, has the advantage of perhaps lingering with you.
I don't want to keep you too much longer. The Grilled Project, it's now become a multimedia platform for what was going to be a book or may still be a book about how brands can thrive in an age of disruption.
Yeah.
Because Moisture has been around for 77 years, yep. And we have reinvented the brand. And as part of the book, now Multimedia Experience, we've come up with 10 commandments of, you know, things one should do to in order to keep thriving and transforming.
Oh, so look, the burning bush.
It's at Moisture's. Where they make the steak.
That's why the steaks taste so good.
That's right. So, I take every one of my podcast guests through these principles. So, comment freely. The first one is, don't take anything for granted.
I totally agree. I think that's something. Don't take anything for granted is something that either you learn or you know. You end up knowing it either way. But it's, I bet you almost anyone in this office right now has learned that, and probably through a bad experience.
And why shouldn't you? What happens if you do?
Well, you don't think things through. You, if you take, as an editor, you know, when you take your reader for granted, you've lost them already. You've stopped the conversation. You know, you're almost talking above their head now. If you're talking about a client, well, you might as well kiss that goodbye. You know, you can't take your client for granted ever.
Right.
I mean, the client is, you know, always right. And you can't take for granted how they're going to feel about something, how they're going to, you know, interpret something, whatever. You know, clients are hard work, and they should be. They're paying the big bucks. And right. And so you can't take anything they're thinking for granted.
You're only as good as your last steak.
Yeah, and you know what the magazine equivalent of that is? You're only as good as your worst page.
Oh, wow.
I totally agree with that.
Times change, but human beings remain the same. This is a controversial one. I'm going to warn you ahead of time.
Well, you know, I mean, the one thing, you know, I mean, I think a lot of content marketers have been talking about storytelling for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And humans have been telling stories since the beginning, you know. I mean, the most human experience probably a long time ago was just sitting around, you know, we invented fire, we sat around it, and we told our story of the day.
Right.
And we're still doing that. So.
True. We still love a story.
Yeah.
It's just the forms that change.
Yeah, exactly.
Remember who you are and make it matter to others.
That's good. I like that. It's true. That's the only thing you have, you know, is who you are. If you're someone else, it's you're coming off as fake, and you're going to get found out sooner or later.
Especially in the age of social media that you just...
And it's going to be found out much sooner.
Know where the bar is set. This is interesting for you because you're doing it now.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, whenever we start anything here, we always set the bar. It's one of the first things we do.
And
it's like, why are we doing this? You know, and this goes beyond, you know, we set goals. We set that with a client if it's a new client. Where do we want this to go? What do we want it to do? And sometimes it's very simple. You know, it might be a dollar value. So we want to sell X number of ads. It might be someone saying, I want 1 million likes on Facebook. Okay, that's the bar, you know. But sometimes, hopefully, the better clients will give you something that actually sounds impossible, and then you realize what the bar is, and you set it, and you go for it.
Honesty is the only policy.
Yes. Honesty. Well, is openness and transparency the same thing?
I think so.
Okay, then it is. Okay, I agree.
Why? Why can't we lie?
Well, I think we can be. I think, you know, especially in certain types of marketing and advertising, you know, we can tell artful forms of honesty. We can leave things out, but and a good story leaves a lot of things out for it to become a good story. But a good story also has to be true. You know, then it's not good. No matter how crazy the story is, it could be set on a planet in a galaxy far, far away.
Right.
But if it's not true, then you've lost the audience. Everything has its inherent inner logic, regardless of, you know, if it's, you know, a documentary film or Star Wars.
Right.
And that inherent logic is the truth.
Tell, don't sell.
Yes. And I think now more than ever, especially with, and I don't want to say millennial, although I just did, but with younger people.
That's also coming off the list, by the way.
Yeah, it has to.
Millennials, like, yeah.
I can't stand that anymore. Yeah. But they can smell the sell a mile away, much more so than, you know, older people.
Mm-hmm.
And they are a very sophisticated audience. And if you are couching, this goes back to your honesty point, if you are couching anything as honest but the only intent is to sell, you better say that right up front.
You know, this is just my own experience because I have a son who's 14, but forget about millennials. The next generation coming up, you know, the way they entertain themselves is by watching YouTube videos that are often... almost all the time homemade by somebody who's just pursuing an interest.
Yeah.
And there's nothing truer than that. That generation will be absolutely impervious to
anything. My friend has an 8-year-old. No, 9 now. And for the last year, he's been making these videos of, like, you know, dominoes falling.
That's very exciting, I think.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Last one is, in a digital age, nothing succeeds like reality.
Well, that's sort of like your last two are sort of A and B, aren't they, in a way?
You tell me.
Yeah. I sort of think they're sort of like two sides of the same coin, you know?
Right.
But, you know, you're talking to someone who writes fiction.
And what's truer than fiction?
Well, I don't know. You tell me, you know. I mean, I don't know. Some days you don't know why we do it, you know. We like to tell stories, but there are a lot of stories out there, and a lot of them are true. And then there are stories that aren't.
With that, one more plug for Waiting for the Man by Ojin Basu, my guest today. You can buy it in your local bookstore. You can get an ebook version. You can take it out of the library.
They have an audio.
Audio book as well.
There's a French version now.
French version.
It's called Attends Moi. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
Attends Moi.
A great, compelling read about a guy called Joe who gives it all up, sits on his front stoop, becomes a media sensation, takes a road trip, ends up on a dude ranch.
Yeah. And you gave nothing away by telling anyone that.
All right. Spoiler alert. He survives.
He survives.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
The Grilled Podcast is made possible by Moishes and produced and hosted by me, Tony Babinski. Robert Marchand masters and mixes, and the music you hear is a song of mine called Havana, from music from the MTL Art Project. Thanks for listening. Ugly John Stone's never been much to look at.